From WGCU News, this is Gulf Coast Life. I'm Mike Canary. Since the novel coronavirus SARS-CoV-2 began spreading across the United States at the beginning of the year, the country's more than 2,000 public health departments have been working around the clock to monitor the disease, provide testing, and inform the public about risks and prevention techniques. It's brought the work done by public health officials at the local, state, and national levels further into the public spotlight than any time in recent years. But as the pandemic has spread and become politicized, it's made the work they're doing even more difficult. On today's show, we're exploring the coronavirus response in the U.S. from a public health perspective with Dr. Marissa Levine. She's professor of public health practice and family medicine in the University of South Florida College of Public Health, where she focuses on population health improvement and teaches leadership. Prior to becoming a professor, Dr. Levine spent 16 years in state government, having served as the Virginia State Health Commissioner, and she led the Virginia Department of Health from 2014 until 2018. She previously held deputy commissioner-level leadership and local health department positions with VDH from 2002 until 2014. During that time, Dr. Levine was involved in the state's response to the H1N1 pandemic, and as commissioner, led the effort to respond to Ebola and Zika, and has significant experience leading public health emergency response efforts at the local and state levels. Dr. Levine is also a retired family physician with 16 years of medical practice experience. She'll be presenting a lecture on Friday, November 13th as part of the Naples Discussion Group's 2021 schedule called COVID-19 Adapting to Change with a capital C. Because of social distancing measures, it will be held via Zoom and is only open to some students of the Honors College. But we're sitting down with her first to get her perspective on what's unfolded this year. Dr. Levine, welcome to the show.
Great to be with you.
Our conversation is pre-recorded, but you can interact with fellow listeners about it and all of our shows. Just find us on Facebook. We're at WGCU Public Media. And on Twitter, we're at WGCU. Use the hashtag GCL. So you served 16 years in state government, including as Virginia State Health Commissioner, and you led the Virginia Department of Health from 2014 to 2018. What has it been like to be out of state government as this pandemic has emerged?
Well, what's really interesting is there are many days that I wish I was back in it, and then there are other days that I'm glad I'm not. So there's a real dichotomy here, and it's been quite a challenge because I know what my public health colleagues are up against, and I spent so much of my career planning for just this scenario. So as a professor, I've been making sure that I find ways to give back to whomever I can help. My colleagues in public health, as well as keeping the public informed.
So you do stay in touch with your former colleagues?
Absolutely, and I'm still part of a national organization of state health officials. They have an alumni group, and we provide a really important component to the work that that group does to support the current state health officials.
There are examples of doctors being brought into certain parts of the country from other parts of the country as sort of, a stopgap measure. Is there anything like that happening in the world of public health where you would be, or somebody like you would be, more formally brought back into the process?
It's possible. And as you know, maybe not obvious to everybody, this year we've seen more turnover in public health leaders than any other year. And that's partly because of both resignations and firings. It's been very traumatic, very difficult for public health officials, particularly those who are in very visible positions. And many of those positions have been filled by former public health officials or other people who have significant public health experience. But at the end of the day, those are really tough jobs that many people don't have the skills, quite frankly, to just jump into.
Have people been fired for, because of the way this has unfortunately been politicized?
Well, when you're in governmental public health, there's always politics, and that's part of the job. You really have to learn how to practice public health, provide recommendations, but do so taking into account what the politics are. And it's a skill, quite frankly, and an art to some degree. So as this issue got highly politicized, in all likelihood, many of the public health officials reached a threshold beyond which they couldn't pass ethically because they were being asked to do things for political purposes that weren't consistent with public health practice.
How closely do you work with the local health department offices there in and around Tampa?
I'm very close. I've played an advisory role to Hillsborough County, and I have close communication with the local health officials who I respect significantly because of the experience that they bring and the hard work that they're doing. But I do provide advisory consultation to them on an as-needed basis.
So how would you rate, and this is kind of a big question, but how would you rate the overall response to SARS-CoV-2 here in the United States as we've watched it unfold?
You know, I hate to be critical, but I'm really disappointed. And I'm primarily disappointed because starting in the Bush administration, George W. Bush, there was significant effort to plan for this very scenario. And I think I was told that he read the book by John Barry, The Great Influenza, which is a fascinating read of the 1918 influenza pandemic. And after reading that, realized how devastating a pandemic at that level could be to the U.S. society. And he, you know, many people had said we need to do more to plan for a pandemic because it's only a matter of time. And he supported it. So I was in local public health at the time, and we had a significant boost in both resource and really a push, if you will, to do better planning, not only around all hazards, but to make sure that we were thinking about a large-scale pandemic, particularly a pandemic of influenza. So we've really planned in the public health arena since about, I'd say, 2006. And after 9/11 and the anthrax attacks, the public health system in the United States was really beefed up and became part of the public safety system, I think is the best way to describe it. And we worked very closely with multiple partners and developed our own competency and policies and procedures to do the very things that are being done now. Since that time, we had H1N1. So that was our first test after all of this effort. And I think we did pretty well. It was certainly not anything as big as what we're seeing now, but it really did identify the weaknesses in our planning. And we beefed up our planning, and then we had Ebola, we had Zika, not to mention many other more local or regional public health emergencies. And then we seemed to drop off in our planning efforts, and we forgot about influenza or to say pandemic, a significant pandemic. So what really concerned me was that the prior few years, up until now, there was just really not a lot of consideration at the federal government, and it trickled down into the state government about a pandemic like this. And you know, that's not to say that there weren't many voices saying we need to beef up our capability. I participated in an exercise that was what we call a tabletop exercise just 2 years ago that was chilling in its prediction for the kind of event that we're exactly experiencing now. It was large-scale quarantines and isolation around a highly infectious disease. And it was clear that we had a lot more work to do, but for whatever reasons, the government didn't pick up on that, and in some cases actually decreased the resources were available for this very thing.
So overall, the federal government hasn't done a good job of learning the lessons that people in your world had learned and the plans that you had made. Are there examples of states that have done that well?
There are states that I think were better prepared, partly because of all of this effort. I'm going to give a shout out to Virginia, where I was, because I think, and actually there were benchmarks identified through this process that allowed states to see how they rated compared to other states. So there were a number of states, and those reports are available through Trust for America's Health, who've been looking at these issues for a number of years now and would rank the states one against the other. And so those states that generally ranked higher, I would say, have generally done better, but nobody was fully prepared for what we're dealing with.
How would you say Florida has done, relatively speaking?
Florida has taken a very interesting, let me just use the word interesting, approach. And I think in the beginning, everybody was very concerned, and it appeared as though we were going to take what we knew, particularly the science behind it, and incorporate that into what needed to be done. But then it seemed to get very political, and it wasn't clear that the science was a key driver in the decision-making. Now, not to say it was easy decision-making. I don't wish that kind of decision on anybody, state or local official. But we got past the first bump in cases, if you will, and then rapidly tried to get back to the old normal, which in my opinion wasn't a really smart idea, because we saw what was happening in places like New York City, and that was just a plane ride or a car ride away from us, and it wouldn't have taken much for Florida to really have significant issues, as we saw in July. We were really teetering in July as the hospitals became stretched, resources stretched, our testing capabilities were stretched, and we were fortunate, I think partly because many people in Florida learned the lessons of New York, and we have an old enough population here who knew that they were at risk, that regardless of what the government did, they were going to be careful. I think that's really helped us all along, but it didn't mitigate the problem to the level that we might have been able to if we had taken a more cautious approach to reopening. So I don't think this is not the end of the story. We're still in the middle of this,
right.
And now we're on an upward trend again, and we're entering a winter flu season, and hopefully we'll have a vaccine. But if we have a lot of disease, that's going to complicate vaccination as well.
When you did the tabletop thing 2 years ago, you said that you mentioned, where does testing fall into that kind of solution in terms of like how robust it should be? Have we just not nearly been proactive enough in trying to make sure there's enough testing, or could we have gotten there with the right resources? Just what are your thoughts on the level of testing we've had and the level of testing that public health officials wish we could have?
We clearly need, even today, more testing, and we definitely needed it early on. If you watch what New York went through, which was really horrible, they've learned from it, and they are now testing widely, and they're testing to make sure that they know when there are new localized outbreaks so that they can contain those and prevent them from becoming larger outbreaks around the whole state or around the whole city of New York, for example. You can only do that if you have adequate testing. And we use that 5% positivity rate as a bellwether, if you will, because we know if we can keep the number below that, the percent of tests that come back positive, below 5%, that gives us an indication that we're probably doing enough testing and we really do know what's going on in the community. And if it's above that, it not only means that there's probably more disease floating around our community, but we're not testing enough. In other countries that have experienced issues like SARS back in, 2003, I think, and MERS, the Middle East Respiratory Syndrome, those are both coronaviruses. They had significant impacts, particularly in Asian countries. Those countries learned, just like New York learned, what they needed to do and what their gaps were. And so they beefed up their system. They have significantly more testing resources, making available rapid test turnaround and good contact tracing that leads to effective isolation and quarantine. Testing is part of a spectrum. It's not just one thing you do. It's how you make, how you get good isolation and quarantine through a contact tracing process. And we've just not gotten there in this country and here in Florida as well.
If there had been like a moonshot for testing at the beginning of this, where the federal government was just like, write a check, we're going to dump as much money as we can toward this, could the system we have ramped up enough to have gotten to the level of testing that somebody like you wish we had?
Yeah, it's a good question because there are many facets of this. You know, I think a lot about the systems involved here. You can't just focus on one. So it's not just the lab we're talking about. The labs were limited, but we saw that they actually had a lot of capability to surge. But you can't do that just with the lab. You need the supplies, and you need the personnel, and then you need a process to reach out to people, collect the tests, distribute them back to the lab, have them tested, and then report back. All of that being done in a very timely basis. So the good thing about planning the way you're talking about it, the moonshot, if you will, is we would look at all the parts of the system and figure out where the gaps were and make sure we addressed all of them. If you don't think that way, then what you end up doing is you just focus on, say, one part of it or two parts of it, very siloed, and all of a sudden you realize, hey, you know what? I don't have anybody making swabs, which was exactly what we were talking about. I don't have personnel. And even if I have personnel, I don't have adequate PPE, personal protective equipment, for them to collect the testing. So that's what would have been required, I think. And this country can rise to that occasion. I don't have any question about that. If asked, we respond, but we need that kind of leadership thinking that way to get us to the point where we need to go.
If you're just tuning in, I'm talking with Dr. Marissa Levine. She's a professor of public health practice and family medicine in the College of Public Health at University of South Florida. She'll be this month's featured speaker for the Naples Discussion Group. To engage with us and your fellow listeners about our conversation, find us on Facebook. We're at WGCU Public Media. And on Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. I want to go over your talk just in a little bit, but I wanted to, real quick, you mentioned contact tracing. It's something that we understand that public health departments have done historically for various diseases. Has there been enough contact tracing done properly during this time, or could there even have been? Do public health departments have the resources to do the kind of contact tracing that is required when there's this many cases?
There is a threshold above which it's really hard to do contact tracing, and it is directly related to the resources to some degree. The Florida Department of Health clearly ramped up their resources to do that. It was a slow build, and nobody really knew how much resource you'd need. But you have to build the resource while you're also trying to tamp down the number of new cases. So you have to look at how many new cases are we getting a day and how much resource we have. And every local health department was looking at that very closely and didn't necessarily have the control over the first part. How can we tamp down it? Because that's in the hands of everybody in the community, everybody doing their part, physically distancing, wearing face coverings, doing hygienic practices, and then also isolating and quarantining where appropriate. So it's a tough arena, and it's hard to do after the fact. And I think that's why some of the Asian countries have done so well. They were burned, literally, by SARS and MERS and learned their lessons. And to their credit, they rose to the occasion to be prepared. And we hadn't learned that lesson, apparently.
So you're giving a talk called COVID-19, Adapting to Change with a Capital C. What do you mean by adapting to change in this context?
Well, we have been hit with a major change called the coronavirus pandemic, or COVID-19 is the disease. We didn't ask for this, and yet it was thrust upon us. So that's the capital C in change. Change is here, and we have a choice. We either adapt or we deny. It's not quite as cut and dry as that, but just for simplicity's sake, some of us have chosen to deny that this is an issue, and others have kind of taken it as the challenge it is and trying to learn how to adapt. And so my talk is looking at those two dynamics and appreciating why it is that some of us don't want to change, and how we might address that, and then what does it mean to adapt to a change like this, such a significant change? And that's what I'll be talking about, because a key part of the adaptation is kind of a mindset, if you will, of ongoing learning, trying, learning again, trying. It's almost like you're navigating in rough waters and you're continually doing course corrections. That's how it feels, and that's how it is in a situation like this. Now, it's understandable why people want to deny this, because none of us like change. Everything we do in our day-to-day lives, what we set up in our communities and our systems, is to minimize change. And as one of the slides I have in the talk says, assures that something that we all want, that tomorrow is just like yesterday, is what exactly happens, because we don't like change. And all of us want that security, if you will, of what we can expect from the next day. However, change is a constant. There really is change every day to some degree. It's just not as drastic as we've seen with the pandemic. And so appreciating kind of the day-to-day perspective on change and how we could live our lives in a way that would help us actually adapt to these large-scale issues like a pandemic, I think is some of the insight I'd like to provide to the group. And at the same time, try to make sure everybody's up to speed on what it is we really know today about COVID-19 and the coronavirus that causes it, and how that can and should inform our actions at an individual and at a community level. So I think there's really a lot of opportunity here. And that's how I think we have to look at it, is that the key to adapting to change is that you have that kind of a mindset that regardless of the impact or event, that we have a growth mindset that we can do this. And we can do it individually, and we can do it collectively, but it is going to take energy, it's going to take collaboration, and to me, that's what has made America great, so why not rise to the occasion and embrace this one and adapt in a manner that gets us to the outcome I think we all really want, which is to have safe, healthy, and prosperous communities where everybody has that opportunity.
I was thinking of the word change for you in this in terms of more like how the health system needed to adapt to change, but I didn't really think about how the human element, the population element fit in, but that's, clearly everyone's adapting to change, and I hadn't really thought about it that way, so thank you for clarifying that.
You're welcome.
So you mentioned leadership before, and you are the you direct USF's Center for Leadership and Public Health Practice. Have we suffered a lack of leadership during this pandemic?
Well, we have leadership. I just think it's not as effective as it could be. And part of the reason I came to USF and resurrected that center was because we clearly, even before the pandemic, we needed to revisit what public health leadership needed to be in order to be effective. Now, the pandemic has only made it more clear that this is an urgent issue. And so my take on leadership is that it's not just leadership of, say, a health department, state or local or national, or governmental officials. It's the kind of leadership which goes back to a great quote from C. Everett Koop, a famous Surgeon General, I think he was in the Reagan years, who said that healthcare is everybody's business some of the time, but public health is everybody's business all of the time. And I think that's what COVID is teaching us and emphasizing, that we are actually all have a role in this. And public health of the future, which I actually would say is the current, ought to be one where we understand what each of our role is, regardless of where we are in society. We all obviously have an individual role, but public health could be a role of the business leaders, for example, who have an obligation to provide safe workplaces or safe places for clientele, and make investments in their community, and might help think differently about how we invest in our community to make it easier for people to be healthy and well, and to set us up to be more resilient so that we can not only resist serious threats, but that we can also recover when they occur. So I think that's where real opportunity is, and that leadership starts with the mindset, kind of a can-do attitude, and one that can see the bigger picture and understand the relationship of the parts so we don't make siloed decisions that have serious unintended consequences.
We've only got a couple minutes left, but what are your thoughts on this news about the Pfizer vaccine stage 3 trial early data showing 90% effectiveness is what they're saying?
Well, we all need some hope right now, so I think this is really hopeful. It's very preliminary information with small numbers, and there's more work to do, but it beats the alternative where they didn't see a positive effect. So I'm excited. I want people to know, though, that it doesn't mean that that the turnaround is imminent on the horizon anytime in the very near future, and I'm talking about weeks and potentially months. We need right now to continue all the things that we know work, the physical distancing, facial coverings, hygienic practices, and the reengineering that business has done to keep us safe in schools, et cetera. And we probably will need to do that through a big chunk of 2021, because I've been involved with vaccine distribution in pandemics through H1N1. It takes time to get the population vaccinated where we can start to have what we would all consider a normal life again. However, we can operate successfully as communities if most of us, if not all of us, do those things I just mentioned and make that part of our day-to-day. That's the secret to getting to the point where a vaccinated community can help us turn around.
You know, I just saw a post right before I called you to start this interview. One of the local news networks posted something about the Pfizer vaccine, and they asked the people to chime in whether or not they would take it. And it seemed like, I know it's not a scientific sample, but it seemed like there were a lot of people saying, heck no. What are your thoughts as a public health person when the population is just rejecting it outright because it's been politicized?
I think it's a really important question. See, when I talk about planning for things like that, for vaccines, it's not just the technical exercise to get the vaccine, a scientific endeavor, and the logistics to get it out. There's a huge communication piece. And the communication goal is to build trust through transparency and understanding and answering of questions and concerns. That's the piece that's been missing. And that has to be a part of the response. And it's exactly what federal, state and local government needs to do between now and whenever a vaccine is actually available for the public is to build trust and to do it in a way that connects without judgment to people to make sure that their questions and concerns are answered. That's the only way that we're going to build enough population of people to take the vaccine to get us to a level of protection that we're going to need.
All right. Well, that is all the time we have. I want to thank my guest, Dr. Marissa Levine, is a professor of public health practice and family medicine in the College of Public Health at University of South Florida. Dr. Levine, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much. You're welcome.
She'll be presenting a lecture on Friday, November 13th as part of the Naples Discussion Group's 2021 schedule called COVID-19 Adapting to Change with a capital C. Because of social distancing measures, it will be held via Zoom and is only open to some students of the Honors College. If you missed any of today's show, you can always hear episodes in their entirety on our website, wgcu.org/GCL, or wherever you get your podcasts. Our show today was produced by yours truly. Our director is Richard Chinqui. Our social media coordinator is Tara Callaghan. For now, thank you for listening. I'm Mike Canary. This is NPR for Southwest Florida, 90.1 WGCU-FM, Fort Myers, Naples, and Port Charlotte, and 91.7 WMKO Marco Island, a member-supported service of Florida Gulf Coast University.